This hour, we'll be hearing excerpts from the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on the proposition, better more domestic surveillance than another 9/11. The live event took place at Asia Society in New York City on the evening of April 18, 2007, and was sponsored by the Rosenkranz Foundation. Speaking in favor of the motion were David Frum, a former Bush speechwriter, currently resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Andrew McCarthy, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and John Yoo, professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley's School of Law. Against the motion were Bob Barr, a former congressman from Georgia who occupies the 21st Century Liberties Chair for Freedom and Privacy at the American Conservative Union, Jeffrey Rosen, legal affairs editor at the New Republic and professor of law at the George Washington University Law School, and Nadine Strossen, president of the American Civil Liberties Union and professor of law at New York Law School. Now, a few words about the format. Every debate consists of an 8-minute opening speech from each panelist, followed by a discussion of questions raised by the audience. The evening concludes with short summary statements from both sides. The audience was polled on the motion, better more domestic surveillance than another 9/11, before and after the event. The entry poll gauged the live audience as 41% in favor of the motion and only 37% against. 22% didn't know. We'll begin by listening to excerpts of the opening speeches. And to introduce the first panelist, here's the event's moderator, ABC News correspondent Chris Bury.
So let's start the debate and arguing for the proposition. David Frum, please take the podium.
I'd like to tell you a little story to begin. About 2 months after I started work at the White House in 2001, there was a rap on the door, not a midnight rap, a daytime rap. My wife went to answer the door, and there on the step was an agent of the FBI. He showed her his badge and asked if he might come in and ask a few questions. Our next-door neighbor, he told her, had just been hired into a sensitive position in the federal government, and as part of the security check on the next-door neighbor, he wanted to ask a few questions. She's a little embarrassed because these were new neighbors. We did not know them well, but to the best of her ability, she gave them a clean bill of health. But jogged by this, she said, you know, we haven't had them over when we really should. So she invited the next-door neighbors over a few weeks later, and they came, and we poured tea and gave them cake, and eventually my wife congratulated them on the husband's new job at the federal government. He said, what are you talking about? He said, I'm still at Sibley and Austin. I've always been at Sibley and Austin. And what we realized was the FBI had meant to come to their house to ask them about me. Tonight's motion is better, more domestic surveillance than another 9/11. And the question is, more than what? And my answer is, more than that. Now, none of us are here to argue for limitless domestic surveillance. But here's the question for today. Should we have more surveillance than we had when those FBI agents were knocking on the wrong door? A level of surveillance that made possible the tremendous catastrophe we know as 9/11. Or should
David Frum concluded his opening statement by citing the cumulative effect of many small government actions since 9/11. He credits these with causing a, quote, dwindling level of sophistication of terrorist organizations.
The terrorists are finding it harder to coordinate. They're finding it harder to communicate with each other. They are under crushing international pressure. Now, it is that level of intensified surveillance of illegitimate activities that has complicated the life of the terrorists and has not made terrorism impossible, has not in any way lessened their desire to do people harm, but that has broken up their ability to communicate with one another, that has made it more difficult for them to move money, and has made it much more difficult for them to strike, and especially to strike inside the United States. You know, all of us here are people who love liberty, but we are also citizens of great cities in the Western world, and we are all potential casualties of attack. And the liberties we are using are the very thing that inflames and provokes those who would attack us.
David Frum,
we are here
to defend
that liberty by defending the higher level of surveillance seen since 9/11. Thank you.
Congressman Bob Barr began his opening statement with a response to David Frum's story.
I promise not to use the example that David gave us of how easy it is for the FBI to screw up something as simple as interviewing the right person for a federal job security clearance as clear an example of why we should not entrust yet additional secret surveillance powers to the government. I promise not to make such an example.
Congressman Barr then continued with a discussion of the 9/11 attackers.
In Pennsylvania, did they succeed because the government was not able to increase its surveillance of those of us in this country? No. Those terrorists succeeded because of a series of tragic mistakes and blunders by government. Our government didn't use the tools that were already available to it. It wasn't because the government lacked sufficient power to surveil Americans. It is a false premise. And what has the government done since then? And what is it even doing now? I guarantee you, if this question, better, more domestic surveillance and another 9/11, is answered by the American people, not just here this evening, but writ large, then you will never, ever see the end of government surveillance power. Sort of like being...
The second speaker in favor of the motion, better, more domestic surveillance than another 9/11, was Andrew McCarthy. Here's an excerpt of his opening statement.
And while our liberties are valuable, but none of them is as valuable as the collective right to life that belongs to all of us. To protect that right, we have to do surveillance. We're fighting an enemy that does not have a territory to defend. It does not have a treasure that we can destroy them by taking. Our only defense is surveillance. And stopping them is far more important than prosecuting them. Prosecutions become cold comfort when the death tolls start to climb into the hundreds and the thousands. And we've seen that. That's not a scare tactic. Against such daunting risk, privacy interests fretted over by our friends on the other side are frankly trifles. What difference does it make if the government has information that your phone company, your bank, and every private vendor that you deal with not only has, but is warehousing and data mining, targeting you, but unlike the government, not targeting you so that they can protect you? The government's ability to access such information may make the difference between life and death. And in the national security context, that access is now subject to various judicial hurdles and congressional oversight, which our law has never imposed on prosecutors and agents who investigate such insignificant, relatively speaking, crimes as gambling. Common sense tells us that under the current threat, this is the kind of investigating that the government not only should be able to do, but must be able to do. If you don't think so, ask yourself about the security you willingly subjected yourself to without any court search warrant the last time you got on a plane or entered a public building. It's a reasonable balancing of minor intrusions to protect ourselves and the people we care about. None of this requires a judicial warrant. None of it requires probable cause. And this has been the case for years and years without any discernible suggestion that the Constitution has been shredded or that our core freedoms have been jeopardized. The thing all the exceptions...
That was Andrew McCarthy. Next, speaking against the motion, is Jeffrey Rosen.
What do I mean when I say that it's possible to protect privacy and security at the same time? I have in mind the evolution of a surveillance technology that some of you may have read about, and we can call this the naked machine, because this is more or less what it is. This is the high-tech, three-dimensional millimeter imaging machine that was initially used at a Florida airport a couple of years ago to detect contraband. It can identify not only metal, but anything that's buried under clothing, ceramics or plastics. It's a very effective X-ray machine. The only downside is that it shows us completely stark naked. Now, the people who designed this machine came up with a simple programming shift. They found that it's able to maintain the pictures of the ceramics or the plastics and the contraband, but to take the pictures of the naked body and scramble the anatomically sensitive regions into a nondescript blob. Now, obviously, this wonderful alternative, the blob machine, as opposed to the naked machine, provides just as much security without any threat to privacy. It shows, in fact, that it's possible to protect our security without any, as it were, domestic surveillance. Now, I'm convinced that all of the laws and technologies that have been proposed since 9/11 can be designed in ways that look more like the blob machine than the naked machine. And it's sheerly willfulness that has led the other side to resist these well-designed laws and technologies for badly designed ones that menace privacy without making us safer. Let me try to persuade you by giving an example of the evolution of one of the most controversial and important surveillance programs since 9/11. This is the program that was originally known as Total Information Awareness. In its original incarnation, the government proposed to unite a lot of information that's held by public and private databases, magazine subscriptions, consumer records, internet browsing, to unite that with public arrest records, and then to conduct vast data mining that would try to predict whose travel patterns resembled those of the 9/11 terrorists and to stop those people at airports. Now, what was wrong with this system? It wouldn't have worked, and it posed grave threats to privacy. But aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, it was an excellent system. Why would it have been ineffective? Well, if you imagine that the next attack looks nothing like the last one, it takes place, God forbid, on a train rather than a plane, then modeling the travel patterns of the 9/11 people will lead to the arrest of a lot of retired businessmen in Florida who take flying lessons but will miss all the real terrorists. And given the huge numbers of false positives, the nation's airports would be brought to a halt. The second problem is privacy. The comparative trifles that Mr. McCarthy so sneeringly dismissed would have allowed the government to store in a centralized database all sorts of records that it could then use to menace its enemies, just as the Nixon administration did when it went after the tax returns of Vietnam protesters and threatened them with prosecution. Now, the evolution of total information awareness is a positive story and one that very much supports our side because of the opposition of a bipartisan coalition of libertarian conservatives like Congressman Barr and civil libertarian liberals like Professor Strossen. The system was refined. First, the government was prohibited from sharing information with law enforcement agents unless there was evidence of a serious crime or a violent terrorist act. And second, the government abandoned the foolish idea of trying to predict future attacks based on the patterns of past ones and instead merely confirmed that people are who they say they are at the airports, a more modest goal, but one that makes us safer. What initially began as a naked machine technology evolved into a blob machine one, and across the range of laws and technologies, we can tell a similar story. So the trade-off that the other side falsely presents you with need not exist. Now, what about the abuse?
These are excerpts from a live IQ Squared US debate. Speaking for the motion, John Yoo countered his opponent's arguments by citing what he considers indicators of the healthy state of civil liberties in America today.
We have had several congressional elections. Political control of Congress just switched in the last election. We have had outpourings of new political speech through new methods and means. For example, people I wish never existed, bloggers. This did not exist before 9/11. Are we really in such a serious civil liberties crisis if bloggers are able to use this new medium to say, I think, quite incredible things? These are always slippery slope arguments. How many American citizens have actually been detained since 9/11 in military detention? It's not the thousands or hundreds of thousands from previous wars. By my count, it's two. How many citizens of other countries in the United States, permanent resident aliens, have been detained? Again, it's not thousands, it's not 100,000s. I think, again, that number is two. So when you try to take into account these factors, the gains of security, which I think we've had, and loss of civil liberties, how should you think about this problem? Let me close by making just a few points. First, have the expansions in government power been worth it? I would say yes. Look at the results. There have been no attacks since 9/11, and this is not because of luck. These expanded surveillance powers have resulted in the capture of al-Qaeda members inside the United States and the prevention of plots. I'll close by saying I think so far we have made a successful balance between civil liberties and security. We have reduced attacks and threats on the country. I think those gains have been worth it. And the question is, I think, for all of us today, is whether we would feel comfortable reducing the amount of government powers and by doing so, give up some of the security we've bought at such a, I think, dear price since 9/11.
John Yoo, thank you very much.
The last speaker against the motion is Nadine Strossen.
Indeed, with more surveillance of the type that has been proliferating since 9/11, namely surveillance that is unjustified, unwarranted, unchecked, not to mention unconstitutional, with more of this kind of surveillance, the terrorists don't need another 9/11 to accomplish their goals. Of course, on that dreadful date, thousands of people were horribly killed. But their tragic deaths were not the terrorists' goal. Rather, they were a means to another, broader goal, to terrify all of us and to sabotage our country's democratic ideals of liberty and justice for all. Second, the constitutional standards, in particular, the Fourth Amendment's core requirement of individualized suspicion, that is designed to preserve both safety and individual liberty. In contrast, too many post-9/11 surveillance programs are just overly broad dragnets, fishing expeditions. And that means, by definition, they are doubly flawed. On the one hand, they're sweeping in too much information about too many completely innocent individuals. And on the other hand, they are failing to hone in on the dangerous ones. As many critics have put it, the government is trying to find a needle in the haystack by adding more hay to the stack.
That concludes the opening statement portion of the debate. We now begin the question and answer period with a question put to Andrew McCarthy by the moderator, Chris Bury.
If, in fact, the war on terror is a war that is not finite, but a war that may last for decades, if not centuries, should the government's power in such surveillance be open-ended? Now, I'd like a quick response, and then if, Bob, you want to pick up on that very point.
Well, of course it should, because the purpose of the power is to prevent attacks, and as long as the threat of attack exists, it would make no sense to get rid of the power.
So this is not a wartime power. You're talking about permanent
It's a threat-time power. It's an asymmetric war fought by a terrorist threat, and these measures are designed as much to thwart the threat as they are to prevail in the ultimate war.
Bob?
The current administration defines this war as unending. It defines it as entirely global. And this administration believes that a president can don that mythical commander-in-chief hat whenever he or she feels like it, and therefore trumps any other power in the Constitution or law. That is the great danger here. The greatest tool with which the government ought to be equipped to avoid another 9/11 is not domestic surveillance, but better, more consistent gathering of foreign intelligence and tearing down the walls between one agency and another that have prevented and continue to stand in the way of effective use of that intelligence, that foreign intelligence.
John?
Chris, I just want to take issue with the underlying premise of your question and Bob's response, which is there's no reason to think the war on terrorism is going to be endless. I think the problem is that we call it the war on terrorism, so we think we're at war with everyone who uses terrorism as a tactic, which is not the case. We're at war with the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization and organizations that help it. And when we defeat that organization, the war will come to an end.
May I add one sentence? I mean, I want
David Frum.
Bob Barr said is very important. Notice he said he's for enhanced foreign surveillance. But the moment that terrorist actually enters the United States, that's when the surveillance must stop. Because I guess then he stopped being dangerous.
I didn't say foreign surveillance. Yeah. I said foreign intelligence.
None of us are saying no surveillance. We're just saying subject to what kinds of oversight and what kinds of protections to make sure that not only is it consistent with individual liberty, but also that it's promoting of national security.
The opposite of more is less.
Not true. It's more targeted, which means it will be more effective. Okay.
Jeffrey Rosen.
The balance that we're arguing for is precisely the one that prevailed before the Patriot Act. And we're not taking issue with all of the Patriot Act, but with those provisions, mostly those dealing with national security letters and warrantless searches, that allow surveillance in secret merely by asserting that it's relevant to terrorism. The small reform that we're arguing for is to restore the pre-Patriot Act requirement that the suspect has to be a suspected spy or terrorist or his associates. And the administration, in rejecting that simple reform, has opposed sunset provisions and made clear that it wishes these changes to be perpetual. So John's notion that these will evaporate is inconsistent with the administration's determination to change domestic surveillance law forever.
My ears are ringing at this phrase targeted.
David Frum.
Because I will agree with you that many of the things the U.S. government does, including those bag searches, are stupid and pointless. But precisely the reason that everybody's toiletries and magazine reading is on display when you enter an airplane is in order to avoid targeting. What the federal government has done since 9/11 is have a very conscious decision that they're going to play, to use a sports analogy, they're going to play the players, they're not going to play the ball. And
David,
so we have this vast, untargeted project, precisely because organizations like the ACLU have opposed things
I'm
like trusted traveler programs.
I'm sorry, you completely misunderstand our position. It depends what the basis is for targeting.
Nadine Strossen.
Individualized suspicion based on what you do, not racial profiling based on who you are.
But the ACLU has opposed the trusted traveler program,
right? Law enforcement officials have agreed that demographic profiling is as ineffective as it is violative of individual rights.
There's
because
as many
the
law
terrorists
enforcement,
can get around the profile very
there's,
easily.
There's as many law enforcement officers who disagree with that as agree with it.
Well,
and your flat statement that the Fourth Amendment requires individualized suspicion is just wrong.
Okay, before we get too deep into the woods of the Constitution, I know we have some folks who have some questions. So who do we have? A young woman in the back right there.
How do we know, how do we have proof that someone's a terrorist until they commit a terrorist act?
Would you like to direct that to one side or one panelist?
Foreign intelligence law, since the law was passed in the 1970s, presumes that there's a level of suspicion that stops short of probable cause that someone's committed a crime, but makes pretty clear that we think that this is a really bad person. And this was a balance that no one suggested caused 9/11. And what's so interesting about the other side is their failure to say that that standard is too high. There's no evidence that anyone wasn't the object of a FISA warrant because there wasn't a high enough degree of suspicion. They want to completely throw out individualized suspicion and have hundreds and thousands of warrants for people who just happened to show up at the airport. So this is not a subtle distinction, and we're convinced that by resurrecting that simple requirement, you could even broaden it a little bit. If you want to talk about the technical details, there have been thoughtful civil libertarians who have said you could have probable cause that someone's a suspected spy or terrorist or his or her associates. At least some connection to an identifiable, dangerous bad guy.
And
it's the dragnet searches that are threatening, and the other side has provided no justification.
Let's let the other side respond. John had a point here.
First of all, I think it's a great question because under the current law within the United States, as Jeff said, you need to have probable cause that someone's a terrorist before you can slap a wiretap on them. And it shows this fundamental confusion between how we think of terrorism. I think the other side thinks of it as a crime and is best handled through the standard criminal justice system, which is this probable cause approach. It makes a lot of sense when, as a society, we are willing to accept the harms of terrorism and retrospectively, after it occurs, then try to use the law enforcement system. What 9/11 showed us is that our government is trying to act prospectively to stop terrorist attacks before they occur. And in order to do that, we cannot rely on a system which says, prove to me that this person is already terrorist because of criminal actions they have already engaged in. Because at that point, usually, as we saw in 9/11, they are already dead, and there's no one to hold responsible in the criminal justice system.
As John himself knows, that is absolutely not the standard. It is much watered down. As Andy said, the court has not applied the strict Fourth Amendment probable cause requirement in this context, but required just some basis for suspicion. And let me tell you, the opposite danger, not only to individual rights, but to national security. The FBI has been complaining bitterly about this sweeping national security agency intercepts because it has led to countless hours of wasted time tracking down, quote, leads that lead nowhere, to dead ends. So again, the notion of honing in on somebody as to whom we have some basis for having suspicion is more effective from a security point of view as well as from an individual rights point of view.
Nadine is again demonstrating the difference between a law enforcement mindset and a criminal justice mindset.
Andrew McCarthy.
If you wait until you have probable cause that someone is an agent of a foreign power, you have waited too long. And that may be what the standard is in the criminal justice system, but the Fourth Amendment has never required that. What the Fourth Amendment requires is that searches be reasonable. And if our goal is going to be to stop terrorist acts rather than to bring people to justice, that has to be the standard that we deal with, and we have to do it with an intelligence mindset, which is far different from the criminal mindset. When the FBI investigates a crime, they expect to bat about 900. Intelligence doesn't work that way. If you hit 1 for 15, you're probably doing well. But it's chasing the needle in the haystack that intelligence is about. And if you're going to apply criminal justice standards to that task, you're finished because
how
you
about
can't prevent
anything. How about 3 out of 153,000?
Let's move off this point just for a few seconds. Do we have another question? Yes, sir, from the audience right there on the end. Yes. There you go.
This is a question for the people against the motion. Would you, any of you feel the slightest bit differently about this proposition if you either trusted the administration or felt that they were competent in the performance of their duties?
We took exactly the same position as did Bob Barr with respect to the last so-called Anti-Terrorism Act under the Clinton administration. And I do have to say that the opponents here are completely ideologically neutral and very diverse. Libertarians, civil libertarians, join forces with a lot of conservative organizations that really are committed to reducing government power over our private lives. And it's because the impulse of government is necessarily to increase its power, regardless of what their politics are. In a wartime situation, they all react the same way, which is to expand their power to the constitutional limit and beyond. And in 2020 hindsight, we look back and we see that none of those measures did anything to add actual protection to our national security.
Nadine, what about the common sense argument advocated by the other side that Americans are more than willing to give up some liberties, whether they're going to a Yankee game or whether they're going through the airport security? Do you see a fundamental difference between that and surveillance on the part of the government?
I think the common sense argument, speaking for myself, and also it's actually reflected in constitutional doctrine, is that no right is absolute. It's just that government has a heavy burden of justification. It has to show that the restriction is going to be effective in actually making you safer, and that nothing that is less violative of your rights would be as effective. And think about it. Of course, most of us would be willing to give up some liberty if that was the price to pay to bring about security. But how many of us would be willing to give up liberty without gaining security in return? Is that common sense? Or to give up more liberty than we have to in order to get the same amount of security?
Well, how about this proposal? What if we were to say, why don't we let not only people choose, but let each person make their own individual choice about how much they personally were prepared to do?
David,
for example,
Frum.
If you want to fly, you can have a shorter line if you're prepared to let the airline know more about you, and a longer line if you're prepared to know the we could each make our choice. And civil liberties union groups have consistently fought and fought and fought when airlines, American Airlines has been promising this now for 3 years. And we could let the market decide. And you could be in the long line. And I'm happy to let them know how long I've been in my present abode and how many kids I have. And I'll go in the short line.
And I have no illusion that that would do anything other than save me time. I have no illusion that would make me safer.
Your answer is no. We will not let people make that individual choice. We will not allow airlines and their customers as private actors to say, let's put this to a truly personal individual trade-off test.
Well, we're not talking about market choices. You can't opt out of a database with 100,000 people in it.
Jeffrey Rosen.
And obviously, people react intuitively to the place where the security hits them. So if they have to wait a little longer, they'll make the trade-off.
The so-called security.
But what we're talking about here are fundamental changes in laws and technologies that make it impossible to escape from dragnet and ubiquitous surveillance and transform the very nature of society. And this is something, just as an environmental law, where market choices are completely inadequate. And that's why constitutional values, whether or not you think that this stuff is required by the Constitution, are implicated.
We've got about 5 minutes left in the Q&A, so we have some questions. Yes, sir. Right.
This is really addressed to the panel against the motion. But what seems to be missing in your argument is a lack of addressing the nature of the threat. And don't you believe that there should be at least some moderation in your point of view and flexibility so that it's one thing to protect individual rights when a relatively limited threat exists, but when you're talking about an existential threat to the nation, don't you have to suspend at the very least this firm, rigorous approach?
Bob Barr.
The threat to our nation at the time the Bill of Rights was drawn up and adopted by this nation was far greater than the threats we face today, I dare say. We faced at the time the very protections against unlimited government intrusion that are embodied, for example, in the Fourth Amendment, were such that the very existence of our nation was clearly threatened by the greatest military power on the face of the earth, and that is Great Britain. Our founding fathers understood that the answer to your question is no. People should not allow government, even facing that level of threat, to invade their privacy without a sufficient reason. And indeed, there is great flexibility that you mentioned already embodied in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Great flexibility. There is tremendous flexibility built into the Patriot Act already. And yet the other side is arguing, by the terms of the question here this evening, is that insufficient, and should government have essentially unfettered power? And the answer to that should be no, the same as it was no in the 18th century, when these very precious mechanisms for guaranteeing our inherent rights were crafted.
John, I think I'd like you to respond to that, because
you're listening to a debate on the proposition, better more domestic surveillance than another 9/11. We'll now rejoin the debate with John Yoo giving his answer to the same audience question that we heard before the break. It concerned civil liberties in times of threat.
There is a system of secret courts and secret evidence that issues secret warrants for secret wiretaps. That system was created in 1978. The Patriot Act amended some of those provisions, but the basic structure is one that we have been happy to live with for almost 30 years. And so this claim that the Patriot Act was this huge revolution, I think, is mistaken. The second thing I would say is, in terms of the ability of the president to go beyond the Patriot Act, every president from Woodrow Wilson on used exactly those same authorities when confronted by a foreign attack or a foreign threat. We're not arguing here for unfettered power. We're not arguing that these powers ought to be used in peacetime. We're not arguing that these powers ought to be used to catch common criminals. I actually personally don't think any evidence from those surveillance programs should be entered into court in any kind of criminal prosecution.
So
they are there to try to prevent a future attack. And it seems weird, right? If you're outside the United States and you're a terrorist, the NSA has unlimited ability to track you. You don't have to go to a court and get a warrant to surveil Osama bin Laden. If Osama bin Laden were to move to the United States, then a whole system of court-ordered procedures are required under the other side's framework. That is a perverse reverse incentive to the one we should be creating.
Let's not exaggerate court-ordered procedures from a court that has almost never denied anything the government has asked for in a secret proceedings, which also has the power, and the government has the power to engage in surveillance before getting a court order. But, John, the most striking thing in your answer, isn't it interesting to hear you say that you oppose the way it has mostly been used, in fact?
I don't think it's – the NSA wiretapping program has not been used to prosecute garden variety crime. I mean,
we're
talking
about the Patriot Act. Remember, the NSA went beyond and around and underneath the Patriot Act.
Most of you – I thought you all just said the Patriot Act was something – most of which you supported, some of which you didn't. But I thought we were talking about the NSA wiretapping program, where there is a very clear distinction about what that evidence can be sought for. It's not to be used for criminal prosecutions, and as far as I know – It never has been used for criminal prosecution.
We don't know what it's been used for because it's been entirely secret, and the government has refused to tell us what it is.
Jeffrey Williams.
We do know that the evidence from the national security letters has been used in ordinary criminal prosecutions. In fact, the Inspector General found that there had been at most 2 terrorism-related convictions, but about 30, which was out of 140,000 letters, only 30 other criminal convictions for crimes that had nothing to do with terrorism. I have to say, the gentleman earlier asked, would you give up nothing? I would make a deal with John. He says, give us this broad, warrantless surveillance power, but we can only use it for intelligence, and we can't introduce it in criminal prosecutions. I would take that deal. That's a deal that the Germans have struck. They allow broad intelligence powers, but it can't be used for prosecutions. And for me, that's an example of the thoughtful balancing of privacy and security that allows us to have both at the same time. But every time the administration has been presented with this deal, it has been completely adamant, has refused to make those sensible trade-offs, and that's why you have to vote against their position.
Thank you very much, and that ends the discussion portion of our evening.
The closing arguments of our debate begin with Congressman Bob Barr speaking against the motion.
I had the opportunity in April of 2000 to testify before the House Intelligence Committee on the issue of whether or not the National Security Agency, or NSA, engaged in or should engage in electronic surveillance of U.S. persons within the United States without court order. My position was that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is the law of the land, required warrants in such instances. There was another gentleman that testified that very same day on the very same issue, General Mike Hayden, at the time head of the NSA, now head of the CIA. He testified, according to Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the government is required to secure a court order because that is the law of the land and the NSA obeys and abides by the law of the land. Strange. That law in its operative parts remains the law of the land today. Yet that same man now takes a very different attitude. There's been no declaration of war. What has changed is simply the perception that now, because of 9/11, the president can order those under him to violate the law because he deems it appropriate and necessary in his perception of his role as commander-in-chief. The fact of the matter is, folks, we are a nation that has a Bill of Rights. It cannot be and should never be allowed to be trumped by those seven words that the president serves as commander-in-chief. The Bill of Rights is the Bill of Rights. It prevails.
Bob Barr?
And the sense of privacy that it protects ought not to be frittered away by granting the government yet more power in addition to the vast power that it already has.
Thank you for your closing remark. And in his final rebuttal, arguing for the motion, David Frum.
I want you to note, as you think about how you're going to vote, both the abstract and the radical character of the arguments of the people on the other side. They're abstract in that they have not given you one example of what you yourselves as individuals ought to be afraid of. What is this tremendous incursion? And I ask you, as you think about this, to think, do I feel less free to speak my mind? Do I feel that there are secrets that are important to me that are more in danger of exposure now than there were before? And then I ask you to consider, how many terrorist attacks have there been on U.S. soil since 9/11, and what is the terrible record through the 1990s, from the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993 to the attack in 2001? I want you also to notice how radical their claim is. We are not debating that better limitless surveillance, better surveillance at the sole discretion of the president, better lawless surveillance. What we are saying is better the higher level of surveillance that has prevailed since 9/11 than this risk. Better more. Their argument is not modulated. It is not balanced. It is to say that nothing, there is to be no more. I sometimes think, as I've been listening to this argument, what would they have said had they been present at the introduction of the stop sign? They would have looked at it and said, this is the first step on the slippery slope toward the total abolition of motion. No one will ever be able to go anywhere ever again. What we are debating here is more and less. We are debating balance. I think that when we identify, as we surely will, specific problems and abuses that have appeared since 9/11, they ought to be fixed. Of course they ought to be fixed. And that is why the original Patriot Act was sunsetted. That is why Congress has oversight powers. Of course those things must be addressed. But we must do this with an understanding of danger. We must ask ourselves, when we look back at that world before 9/11, when people in the same agency were not even allowed to talk to each other about what they knew, is that where we want to return to?
David Frum, thank you.
Thank you.
And against the motion, Jeffrey Rosen.
We don't need lectures on radicalism from the other side. This was the administration, led by our distinguished opponents, who argued that the president has the unilateral authority to ignore or reinterpret laws, including the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Law, with which he disagrees because it infringes his power as commander-in-chief. And this is the administration that has indeed used the broad and sweeping new and radical powers that it's been granted, which were a warrant for unreviewed, limitless surveillance by the FBI in ways that had nothing to do with terrorism. They are the radicals. Our position is the traditionally conservative position. We merely want to restore the law as it was before the Patriot Act. We're willing to engage in the kind of sensible compromises that came out in the debates. We are not uncompromising at all in this regard, but we want to avoid a transformation in American liberties from which the country might never recover. David Frum asked for a specific example. I'm happy to provide one and to close with one, and that's the example of Britain. Britain, the cradle of Western democracy, was the country that wired itself up in the 1990s with so many surveillance cameras that it now resembles the set of the Truman Show. This was defended as a way of stopping IRA terrorism, but the cameras are now used for very different purposes. They're used to charge a car tax for every car that comes into the city, and recently we learned microphones have been set up in city centers to have ominous voices warning people when they're getting drunk in public. I experienced a society that had microphones and surveillance cameras, and that was in Warsaw in 1988, right before the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the British public is indifferent to statistics showing that there is no connection between the spread of the cameras and the decline or prevention of violent crime or terrorism. So these things are indeed small incursions, and even free societies can transform themselves incrementally in ways whose effects are only beginning to be understood. Ubiquitous surveillance that might make it possible to see where I get up in the morning, which subway I take, and Jeffrey, where I end up going to work is not an Orwellian impossibility, but a very real probability, and we ask you to resist it by voting against the motion.
Jeffrey Rosen, thank you. In his closing thought for the motion, Andrew McCarthy.
With due respect to the other side, what you're hearing is radical. We now have increased surveillance. We've had it since 9/11. I don't think it's sweepingly increased surveillance, but it's certainly increased surveillance beyond what we had in the 1990s. What they're telling you is better another 9/11 than increased surveillance. Now, this is New York. Ask yourself, what have you been going through for the last 5 years, 6 years, whether it's keeping you up at night, that the government is frittering away with your personal information or whatever else it is that is the grave concern here, and ask yourself if that's anything like what 9/11 was like, and whether in a million years you would ever want to go through anything like that again, if you could instead deal with the kinds of trade-offs between liberty and security that we've had in the last 6 years. That's not even a contest. And to say that it is, that's about as radical as anything I can imagine. Now, one of the last thing I'd like to address is this idea of perfect security and risk of error. Investigation, whether it's law enforcement or national security, is a human process, and we are not going to be able to repeal human error. There are going to continue to be errors. There are going to continue to be roguish acts by people who are rogues. Rogues are going to be rogues no matter what the rules are. When you change the rules, when you clamp down on what your agents are able to do, what you're actually clamping down on are the good faith people who you didn't need to worry about in the first place. These powers are in place because they're needed to ferret out potential threats, because there is no perfect security. We can wire the whole place up with cameras and bugs and the like.
Andrew.
But we can't prevent every attack.
Thank you. Andrew McCarthy, thank you. And her closing thought, Nadine Strossen.
I'm afraid that Andy has not understood our position at all. Our position is that more surveillance of the sweeping, random, mass dragnet type we are complaining about, and security experts are complaining about post 9/11, is not going to prevent another 9/11. And in fact, not only is it ineffective, but it is actually counterproductive to the security goal, because it is deterring and diverting resources from measures that the security community has a consensus would be more effective. Let me give you a couple specific examples. The mass gathering of data about all of our communications. The government tells us it's going to engage in data mining. Sounds really impressive, doesn't it? Of course we would like to believe it would work. Well, you know who knows that it doesn't work? Security experts and computer experts. Let me quote one. Professor Farley at Harvard University, who is a science fellow at Stanford Stanford Center for International Security, complaining from a security perspective about the NSA domestic spying program. He says it is based on a false assumption that you can work out who might be a terrorist based on calling patterns, but guilt by association is not just bad law, it's also bad mathematics, security theater, not real security. And, you know, we put in place, understandably, the Patriot Act, NSA domestic spying shortly after 9/11. Government officials, to their credit, wanted to do something to at least make us feel more secure. But you can't do anything meaningful until you have looked at what the actual causes were of that horrible catastrophe on 9/11. And that kind of analysis was not done until much later by the Joint Intelligence Committees of both houses of Congress and by the Bipartisan Citizens Commission. And they did not recommend the kind of mass surveillance measures that have been advocated by our proponents. And in fact, again, the common sense, concrete steps that all of us blindly assume have been taken have not, in fact, been taken. John Yoo said, well, we've already done all of that. Well, that's not what Tom Paine thinks, the chair of the 9/11 Commission. He says it is scandalous that police and firefighters in large cities still cannot communicate reliably in a major crisis. We oppose the resolution because it is bad for security and freedom.
Thank you. And now, batting cleanup for the proponents, John Yoo.
Well, first I want to apologize for the lack of rhetorical skills on at least my part. That should not prevent you from voting for our side in the debate. I've just admired the rhetorical gifts of everyone else on the panel. And that, from what I can tell, that it consists of calling the other side radical and exaggerating what they actually want to do in the real world. Two things. One is I think the other side fundamentally confuses war versus crime. Ask yourself this. If the Soviet Union had carried out the 9/11 attacks in exactly the same way, exactly the same people, would we not be at war? And wouldn't we not be justified using wartime measures to try to stop al-Qaeda from carrying out a second attack? Why is the fact that they are not a nation state require us to go back to a criminal justice system, the pre-9/11 world? The second thing I'll just say is it's an empirical question whether the security of our country has gone up in response to the increased surveillance measures. I think that has. There's the person who wanted to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge was caught only because of these new measures. That guy who wanted to carry out terrorist attacks in Florida and Southeast America, the United States, who fled the country, he was only identified and an alert went out only because he was identified through his expanded surveillance techniques. So there's still more we can do. I think the FBI is utterly incompetent. It's because they try to do drug dealing, white-collar crime, which I'm sure is of interest to many of you in New York, and all kinds of other things, and counterterrorism. The reason we keep them all together is out of civil liberty concerns. I would say let's get rid of the FBI, create a real national security counterterrorist agency, and let the states and the states control drug crimes, white-collar crimes, and get the FBI out of the job of trying to do bank robberies and kidnappings. I think that makes no sense. That's an improvement we can make, but would require you to vote for our side.
And right on time. We like that.
And that concludes our debate. The audience was polled a second time at the end of the evening on the resolution Better More Domestic Surveillance Than Another 9/11. This time, the speakers against the motion managed to sway the audience to their side. The final poll gauged the audience as 40% in favor of the motion. That's just about the same as before the debate. But by the end, 56% voted against, up a considerable 19 percentage points from the entry poll. 5% said they didn't know. That was down from 22%. To hear the full unedited version of this or other debates in the IQ Squared series, or to subscribe to our podcast, visit npr.org/intelligencesquared. The Intelligence Squared U.S. Debate Series is an initiative of the Rosenkranz Foundation. Chairman Robert Rosenkranz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series, or to find out how you can get tickets to attend future live events, visit www.iq2us.org. That's www.iq, the numeral 2, intelligencesquaredus.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared U.S. is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. This series is produced for radio by WNYC, New York Public Radio, producer Rob Christensen, senior producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Damon Whittemore, Dan Molad, and Edward Haber, production assistance from Scott Goldberg. Intelligence Squared U.S. is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.